Hello, and welcome to the ToxPod. I'm Peter Stockham. Welcome to part two of our Rome special. This episode starts off with an interview with Victoria Marland, talking about benzodiazepines in Scottish prisons. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk that just then. It was very interesting. It was on changing trends of benzodiazepine use within Scottish prisons, and it's very interesting. Things are really going on there, aren't they?
Yes, it's very... We're seeing lots of increasing variability in the types of benzodiazepines that we're detecting. There's lots of polydrug use going on because one of the biggest issues is they went through a phase of infusing things into textiles and paper and card. And due to this, that there's not really any way of telling at all what they might contain. And because synthetic cannabinoids for a long time have been infused in paper and card, we've kind of gone through a period of time where it's, are you getting a synthetic cannabinoid? Are you getting a benzodiazepine? And obviously they have very different effects. You use them in very different ways. So there is a lot of harmful drug use going on within the Scottish prisons.
It's a strange environment, isn't it? Because there's restricted access and they have to work out ways of getting drugs into the prison. Yep. So you were saying they changed the modes of smuggling drugs into the prison. They started off with paper?
Yes, well, they started off with powders and tablets, and we did also see some blotters in 2020. But during COVID, it's about August of 2020, we saw quite a dramatic increase in benzodiazepines coming in the mail system, so infused in the paper and card. And we think that this was likely due to there were lots of lockdowns that meant that there were fewer jury trials going on. So there were significantly fewer individuals going in and out of prison, and of course visitors were no longer allowed into prisons. So this would have impacted suppliers' abilities to directly transport these substances into the prison. And because synthetic cannabinoids have been established as smuggling them through the mail for a long time, and so it would have been a really easy leap for the suppliers to make to go from powders and tablets to infusing them. But then because of this increased number of substances going into the prison through the mail systems, the Scottish prison started photocopying all the mail, and they were issuing the photocopies instead of the original items. Right. And so then we've seen a big decline from the start of 2022. It's gone right back to powders and tablets again. So all of our samples are non-judicial samples, so they're ones that can't be attributed to anybody. But there's a lot of throwovers, and they monitor all the incoming mail. So we're picking them up.
So maybe we should go back to the purpose of why you're looking at this. Is this part of the monitoring of the system, or is it more a research issue?
So it's all part of the monitoring. There's a big project known as the Scottish Prisons Non-Judicial Drug Seizure Monitoring Project. It's a mouthful. They're monitoring everything so that they can kind of inform their harm reduction strategies. And they're also, one of the screening methods that they use is eye mobility spectrometry. So we use a lot of this data to inform what alarms should we be setting on the system so that the prison officers are able to pick up. Just recently we added some new compounds on that had been kind of rising in prevalence, and therefore we added them on so that the prison officers were definitely able to detect them.
Yes, so these eye mobility systems have a set library, so you just have to add the new NPS to the library.
Yep. Yes.
And most of the substance you're seeing are benzodiazepines. Is that correct?
My PhD focuses on novel benzodiazepines, so that's kind of where this piece of work came from. The most common substance that we're actually seeing is the synthetic cannabinoids. They were briefly overtaken early this year, where for the first time there were more benzodiazepines than there were synthetic cannabinoids. However, it's flipped back again. But we are seeing, we're also seeing lots of traditional drugs coming in as well. We have detections of cocaine and heroin and cannabis coming through too.
So there was one example you showed of a greeting card. You had a photograph of a greeting card. And I sort of imagined that when they infused something, they sort of just did it on a little tiny part of the card so that they could knew which bit to smoke or ingest. But the whole card was covered in a tizzle. I mean, it was quite a large dose.
Yes. So what we think they do is kind of either spray or submerge to infuse them. We have had studies. My colleague, Caitlin Norman, she did some studies previously on synthetic cannabinoids where she mapped them, and she found that it was very obvious that they were being hung up to dry because there was a denser amount of synthetic cannabinoid at the bottom than there was in other areas. However, with my card, we've seen that it was more evenly distributed, so they're obviously laying them flat to dry them or something now. But we think that they either spray or submerge them too.
And the amount of etisalam was on that particular one was quite astounding. It was 200 pills or something equivalent?
So equivalent to 306 tablets. So we calculated that on average there was about a milligram of etisalam per tablet. And So a milligram of etisalam is approximately equivalent to 10 milligrams of diazepam. So we know that kind of on average, although we did see a lot of variability, they do seem to be taking the equivalent of a standard dose of diazepam. But obviously with a card, we have no idea whether they're taking 5 centimetres, whether they're soaking the whole card in a kettle. So it is really unpredictable dosing. It is very dangerous.
That's probably good currency within the prison system too, to have that many equivalent tablets,
yes.
But yeah, or very, very dangerous to one individual.
Yes, yes, yeah. And of course, there is now that, is it a SCRA? So, I mean, if they are drinking it, SCRAs are very readily metabolised, so they're probably not going to get too much. But if they then are smoking the card instead, we don't fully understand the harms of what happens when you smoke a benzodiazepine. So yeah. There's a really a gap in the research then.
But do many of these actual physical cards get through to the prisoners now, or are they still photocopying them?
So they are still photocopying them, and we think that they have kind of stopped using that method because they are still swabbing everything. So the fact that we're not really seeing any of that come through anymore, it suggests that they have kind of diverted away from using the mail systems as a way of smuggling benzos.
And the most common drug was bromazepam?
Bromazepam, yes. So bromazepam is now the most, I think it accounted for 48% of our samples that we saw in quarter one of this year. It was 67% in quarter two, but we've only had 6 samples of benzos within that cohort. So it's not very representative because it's only 6 samples. But yeah, it is now the most. It's overtaken etisalam since etisalam's international control.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Victoria. It was a very interesting talk. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Sarah Russell from New Zealand. Thanks for joining the ToxPod.
Thanks for having me.
You had a sad but quite interesting and unusual talk today about colchicine poisoning, 8 cases in New Zealand.
That is true. We've had 8 cases since 2019 to 2022, 6 of which were in 2021. The most surprising feature was the ages of the people. I mean, 3 16-year-olds. These are not people that you associate with colchicine. Because you use colchicine for gout.
Yes.
I mean, that's arthritis, that's uric acid, it's the swollen red toe. It's what you associate with King Henry VIII. Yes. It's not what you associate with young 16-year-old girls.
It's extremely unusual to see that. So let's talk a little bit about colchicine as a medicine, because it started off, as many medicines do, as a natural product, and now it's used therapeutically. But it's a very low-dose drug, is that correct?
That is correct, yes. You only take 0.5 milligrams. And for an acute attack, you would only take 2 tablets and then an hour later take 1 more. So it's a maximum of 1.5 milligrams for an acute attack. So you're not looking at things, because it's got a very low therapeutic index. It's highly toxic.
And does anyone know what the motive behind taking this? It's in no way a drug of abuse. Is it perhaps an accidental substitution or something like that?
It's not a drug of abuse. So you're looking at substitution, or you're looking at somebody taking it out of a medicine cabinet because the tablets looked like paracetamol tablets in New Zealand. So maybe if you've got a headache or you're going to get the thing, you just pulled open the cabinet and you didn't read the packet properly.
The concentrations that you found in some of the deceased were quite high. They're all way above therapeutic. I mean, I know you have post-mortem distribution, but they were up to 1 milligram per litre. Did I read that correctly?
Yes, you did. And they were anti-mortem samples because these were taken in hospital, because you basically, with a half-life of 20 to 40 hours, this drug hangs around for a long time. But unfortunately, the people do die, and it takes days to die.
Yeah, it's a very sad way to go. What are the symptoms of a colchicine overdose?
Well, the first symptoms you have at home would be just your normal vomiting, diarrhoea, tummy bug feeling thing, but you get a very sore throat. That's when you start hemorrhaging, and you have the hemorrhage problem behind it.
I know colchicine is actually used in cell biology because it freezes the meiosis process and it holds the chromatograms open. It's a really weird chemical, but obviously that's probably what some of the damage is being done. It targets the fast-growing cells, perhaps.
Yes, it must be. Yes, it's very highly toxic, and unfortunately, if you don't have very good liver or kidney function, it's basically, you've got no hope.
Right. But these are young people, so they obviously probably had...
It's very tragic, I have to say. It's incredibly tragic to 16-year-olds.
Was there any cultural distribution for the use of them?
Well, only one was Caucasian, and that, I think, is a problem because the non-Caucasians are overrepresented in New Zealand with health problems such as with relating to liver and kidney function. And you need to have good health, liver and kidney function for you to actually be able to tolerate colchicine, whether you're prescribed it or not.
Now, in 2 years' time, you'll be hosting the TEFT meeting in New Zealand.
Yes, in Auckland 2025 in November. And we're very much looking forward to seeing everyone there. And we're very much looking to putting it on. We have a brand new conference venue and everything going for it.
I'm really looking forward to it. And the good news about it is it's the same distance from New Zealand to Europe as it is from Europe to New Zealand. So you go to Europe to see conferences?
Yes, so they should come and see us.
Yes. That would be great if they could.
It would be fantastic to see everyone there. Yeah. We really do hope to have them there.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Okay, Elena Holt, welcome to the ToxPod. Tell us a little bit about where you work and why you're here.
Hi, yes, thank you so much for having me. My name is Elena Holt. I'm a PhD candidate working in the Laboratory for Forensic Toxicology at Virginia Commonwealth University in the United States. Our lab does a lot of research with electronic cigarettes, and we have also been following the evolution of all of the cannabinoids across the United States, which is a pretty complex and complicated subject matter right now.
For sure, and you're concentrating on semi-synthetic cannabinoids, so these aren't the normal. We almost got used to all these different scras that were coming out, but these are semi-synthetic. So do you want to start us with where this whole semi-synthetic aspect came from? How did it get started in the US?
Yes, I'd love to. So really, what precipitated this current situation was the 2018 Agricultural Improvement Act, which delineated marijuana from hemp based on a 0.3% delta-9 THC dry weight basis in the plant material. So it also legalized the growth of hemp in the United States, which created this CBD boom in the market. There was just CBD everywhere. And because of that, the price eventually fell. So all of these CBD manufacturers had to turn to some other way to continue making profits, or their stockholders were going to come at them angrily. So the easiest solution was just to take CBD and convert it into another desirable compound. And they figured out that just with some really quick, simple chemistry, you can take CBD and turn it into delta-8 THC, delta-9 THC, delta-10 THC. And then if they want to, they can take it one step further and start synthesizing the THC acetates or some of these other isomers and derivatives. So that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
Okay, so these drugs are illegal, though, or are they still semi-controlled or not controlled?
Great question. So federally, THC and its isomers are technically illegal. Delta-9 is still a Schedule I substance in the United States, and we do have the Analog Act. However, state-wise, many states have started legalizing either medical or recreational Delta-9 THC use. So now we have this patchwork all across the United States where some states it's legal for recreational and medical, some it's only medical use, and some states have a zero tolerance policy still. So now we have even more confusion for public consumers.
Marijuana is quite available anyway in America, isn't it? In certain states, I guess. Is it also a way to avoid detection? So if you're on a work site or something, do you use Delta-8 or Delta-10?
So I would say that many labs are still getting up to speed with all of these new isomers. And unless they are able to separate out the different isomers chromatographically, they're only going to say it's THC. They can't differentiate between the delta-8 or the delta-9 or the delta-10. So even if you were just using a delta-8 product that had no delta-9 in it, it could show up as a delta-9, okay, depending on who's doing the testing.
Now, you're particularly looking at e-cigarettes. What's the status of e-cigarettes? We had an interview with Michelle Peace couple of years ago, probably. It may have changed a little bit since then, but at that stage, they were still fully legal in the United States. Has it been restricted at all?
So e-cigarettes themselves are still fully legal. There have been some laws and regulations that came out that have tried to restrict some of the constituents of them, particularly some of the flavorants, in an attempt to thwart underage juvenile use of them. They are still trying to play catch-up, though. The FDA is still trying to kind of get their arms around regulating these products. So they are still widely available, and unfortunately, many unregulated liquids and e-cigarettes are on the market.
So we're still having trouble with chronic use or maybe once-off use causing serious lung damage. Is that happening occasionally still, or they refine the constituents?
So honestly, I haven't heard too much about EVALI in the recent years. Mostly it's just been COVID talk, and now we have everyone talking about cannabis and legalization and all of that. I'm sure it is still happening. There wasn't any one compound that was identified as causing that lung damage. I think it was more just entourage effect where we have multiple chemicals entering your lung, which is a very delicate tissue, causing these reactions.
And so getting back to drugs, obviously selling illegal drugs in vaping liquid is not legal.
Yes, correct, yes. So I think most of what we're seeing outside of these semi-synthetic cannabinoids, the fully synthetic cannabinoids that still pop up occasionally, are mostly coming from outside of the U.S., just coming in through shipping. You know, you can get almost anything online that you want these days. So even if there's hard regulations within the land structure of the U.S., you just have to turn to online to get whatever you want.
And you've done some extensive testing. What was the results of your testing of a bunch of e-liquids that you talked about yesterday?
Yeah, perfect. So we do monitor all of these vendor websites, and we will purchase products that we see that are new. They're advertising some of these new synthetic cannabinoids. And when we analyze them, the general findings are that the labeling is inadequate. So they'll often say that it contains something, and when we analyze it, that compound is not present. Or we'll find additional pharmacologically active ingredients in the products, such as additional cannabinoids that either didn't get purified out or they just didn't bother doing any sort of purification. We've found synthetic cannabinoids. We find ethanol in many e-cigarettes, which is its own problem. We've found things like dextromethorphan, which is the over-the-counter cough syrup active ingredient. So all kinds of things. And on top of that, often what concentration is on the product label is not what we have quantitated within the product. So you're getting over-labeling and under-labeling, both of which can be problematic for consumers because they might not get the desired effect, so they take more and then they have an adverse reaction. Or if it's been under-labeled, they take a dose that actually has more than they expected and then they, again, have an adverse reaction. And that's one of the things that we've started doing is people are reaching out to us saying, I've taken this product and I had this horrific reaction. Most of the time, people are experiencing hallucinations. We've had people take products and think that they were being controlled by someone else. They commit felonies. You know, there's all kinds of traffic accidents. We had a gentleman take a honey stick that contained 14 times the concentration that was labeled. He had a hallucination in which he thought his legs had been chopped off or across the room, and he was unable to get to them to then therefore call for help. So really traumatic, horrifying adverse reactions are happening. So they're sending their products to us for analysis just to get some answers because they don't know where else to turn to.
That's fantastic. So this is part of a university service. It's not a fee-for-service or anything.
So this is just from our lab. We have people that will reach out, and depending on the case, if it's something we think we can do and help them with, we will ask them to ship a product to us. If it's the product that they took initially, that's best. If they can find a duplicate product in the market, we'll take that. We do worry about batch-to-batch consistency, so the initial taken product is best. But yeah, it's a service we offer for individuals. We do have some attorneys and other parties reach out for legal purposes in which we can do a fee-for-service work.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a very interesting talk, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Hello, Jeremy Carlier. How are you going?
Very well. And you?
Not too bad. Welcome to the ToxPod. Your talk was one of several on these semi-synthetic cannabinoids, and yours in particular was about HHC, or hexahydrocannabinol. Maybe you might like to just take us through a little bit about what HHC is and where it comes from and how it's come to be important these days.
Sure. So first, HHC is a natural cannabinoid in the sense that it naturally occurs in cannabis as a degradation product of THC, right? But it's only present as traces in the plants. In the scientific literature, it was first described and synthesized by Adams and Todd, I believe, in the 40s from THC. So as you said, this is a semi-synthetic cannabinoid. But now it's mainly produced from CBD, which has become much more available recently. And since a couple of years, it's been used for recreation as a substitute for THC because it induces also cannabinoid effects. And it got a tremendous exposure in the media. And indeed, many positive cases were reported in the USA and in Europe recently. And I say it from France, Italy. So HHC is really a hot topic right now in research.
THC stands for tetrahydrocannabinol. So hexahydrocannabinol is obviously two more hydrogens. So in one of the rings of the THC structure, it's completely saturated. And the difficulty for scientists like us is that there's now another chiral center there, which then means that HHC has now got two epimers.
Yeah, exactly. So during the synthesis, two different epimers are created due to the formation of a new chiral center, as you said, so in position 9. So, and indeed, HHC is sold as a mixture of the two compounds. So we have R and S HHC, depending on the configuration of this carbon 9. And it seems, and it's very interesting, that this is the R epimer, or you can say the beta epimer, that carries most of the cannabinoid effects. So in analytical toxicology, it's very, very important to be able to make the distinction between R and S isomers, so either by the detection of the parents or the metabolites.
Yeah, so how do you separate them?
So many researchers managed to separate the two compounds in GC-MS, so I think with a derivatization, which makes things easier. But in LC, it's a little more complicated because the two compounds are very similar and it's very difficult to resolve them chromatographically. So I saw a technical note from, I don't remember, from Waters, maybe. But anyway, they managed to separate the two compounds. But in usual screening methods, I don't think the two isomers are separated.
Sure. So you worked on both in vitro and looking at actual urine from HHC users. What did you find in vitro?
So we incubated R and S HHC with human hepatocytes. And we found that R and S isomers had a different metabolization and produced different major metabolites. This is a very interesting result. And in urine, so from three users, we found major metabolites of HHC consumption. And by comparison with in vitro results, we were able to identify specific biomarkers of R and S isomers. But of course, these results need to be confirmed with the analysis of urine from subjects after the administration of either one or the other epimer.
So HHC is found as a glucuronidated parent in the urine. That's unlike THC, for example. Is that the case that you found?
So actually, THC glucuronide is found in urine also, even if it's minor compared to THC-COH glucuronide. But we have similarities between THC and HHC. So just like HHC, THC and metabolites are mostly conjugated in urine. So this is one thing. But we also have some major differences. So due to the lack of this double bond in C9 and C10, which makes this part of the molecule less susceptible to hydroxylation. So one big difference is 11 carboxy and 11 hydroxy metabolites, which are major for THC after hydrolysis, are only minor for HHC. So this is a big difference. And instead, we have major metabolites with a hydroxylation at the pentyl chain and dehydroxylations. And interestingly, lots of researchers rushed on developing methods for detecting HHC-COH in urine, but it seems that maybe it was not a good call.
Okay, that is interesting. Well, thank you very much for your time, Jeremy.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm here with Michael Scholes. Welcome to the ToxPod once again. We spoke to you last year.
Yeah, happy to be back. Hi, Peter.
You're from the University of Zurich, working with Thomas Kramer's lab. And last year you were talking about driving under the influence of sleepiness and a pilot program to look at biomarkers in oral fluid to see if you can characterise someone's sleepiness level. Is that more or less what you were doing last year?
Yeah, pretty much. So last year I presented the pilot study, and that paved the way for the actual study, which we performed this year, and that was what my presentation was about.
This year you went into a lot of detail about the sleep experiments that you did. You once again tortured people by making them stay up for a full night, which is fine. But you also had three classes of degrees of sleepiness. You had people who were just had a normal sleep pattern, others who had a reduced sleep pattern over three nights, and the third group, they missed an entire night of sleep, so they went for 20-odd hours worth of without sleep. How did you determine levels of sleepiness?
Well, we thought in this study we would need some more of a holistic approach and be very close to reality. Like all the tests that we did and all the sampling time points, we wanted to be as close to reality as possible. And also then, of course, with the sleep schedules. Yeah. So we had a control group, of course. People were well-rested, as you said. And then typically the work week schedule being restricted by a couple of hours per night over a week is, I think that's what we all know best.
Yep.
And then of course the ultimate scenario of total sleep deprivation, like going on a party for a night. But this we hope that we could get closer to the effects that we see in reality later.
So it was an enormous project. You had it must have been an enormous amount of organization gone into getting it done, because you had driving simulators. What other sort of tests were you doing?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the driving simulator was definitely the heart of the project, I would say. And there were other tests, performance tests, reaction tests, attention tests, and of course a lot of questionnaires seeking to evaluate people's subjective feeling of sleepiness, because obviously sometimes your subjective feeling of sleepiness might not what you would be seeing in a objective test.
Yeah, so
right?
You might feel okay, but actually be impaired.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Underestimate or overestimate yourself even. And then, of course, all the sampling procedures, like we assert blood, we had oral fluid, exhaled breath, and even finger sweat.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So these were standard sleep. A few of these tests were standard sleepiness tests. They would have been done before, I guess, for drugs like ethanol. Is there any way to compare the study that you did with those ones?
Yeah, usually with all other drugs of abuse and also sleepiness, you usually would like to compare the results with other studies that had performed the same with alcohol, because of alcohol we all know it jeopardizes traffic.
Yep.
And the effects are very well described and characterized. So as a first indicator, you always compare with ethanol. So yeah, of course, the procedures were pretty much the same, the scales, the tests, all highly validated and gold standard since decades.
Could you equate that to an equivalent level of alcohol, the sleepiness, say after one night of without sleep, or was that not possible?
Yeah, look, for example, as I showed in the presentation, is that we found for, say, the lateral position of the car, so how people maneuver the car, it's a measure of control of the car, basically, and we found that it exceeded the threshold of clinical relevance, and that threshold actually was set up in from many studies where people were under the influence of half a gram per liter blood. Yep. Alcohol concentration, which is the legal limit in many countries.
Yes.
So that threshold is basically, yeah, what you were looking for. And we've seen that it was clearly exceeded after sleep deprivation. However, not after sleep restriction. That is an interesting finding.
Mm. So that sleep restriction means that you reduce their total sleep over 3 days. And so the cumulative sleep was the same, but you had, in these ones, they did have some sleep the night before.
Exactly. So the total deficit was the same. It was 8 hours, but they accumulated over 4 nights, exactly. And that seems to provoke a different answer in our bodies than acute sleep deprivation does. Mm-hmm. So there will be other mechanisms going on, and also we hope to find that in the metabolome later on, in the biological samples. There's our body somehow compensates differently.
Right. It's quite fascinating. So the next step is, I guess, to do some scatterbomb analysis of metabolites, and that will be coming up next year, maybe.
Yeah, we definitely hope to present that next year.
Okay.
I would say as soon as the gods of mass spectrometry allow. Yeah, we are right to it. We are into it as we speak, Peter.
Are you praying to the vacuum god or the electronics god?
Both of them.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael. Good luck.
You're welcome. Thank you, Peter.
Now, next year's TAF conference is going to be held in Switzerland, in St. Gallen,
Joining me now from Switzerland is Jochen Bayer. How are you going, Jochen?
Good. I'm good. Yeah. Doing well. How are you?
Very well. Now, I've just come back to Australia. I tried to catch up with you after the TF meeting, but it was a little bit too busy. I wanted to catch up with you to talk about what is going to be happening in St. Gallen next year. Could you tell us about the TF meeting?
Yeah, St. Gallen. We are very happy to for the TF World to come to St. Gallen. We have planned a very regular TF meeting with a typical five-day program, 5 days of a whole lot of science, many, many scientific sessions, none of them parallel, and only talks, no plenary lectures, just scientific talks, many, many posters, flash poster presentations, and probably also a bit of social fun.
Sounds good. I was talking to you about it during the meeting, and you were saying that, well, it was reminiscent of me, what you were saying, as what a meeting in Bonn was, one of my first TF meetings 10 years ago, and that was Hans Mara's meeting, and his focus was the science. He said, no plenaries. It was basically 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. oral presentations.
Yeah.
With a decent break in between.
That's the school I'm coming from. So, yeah, now in that sense, it will be fairly similar, but we will have long enough breaks in between so that you can also focus a lot on our very large exhibition hall. So we have a very massive exhibition area, and I'm hoping that I'm at the moment working with a lot of sponsors and exhibitors that we will have also an exciting booths up there.
You mentioned that it's not just scientific exhibitors that you're going to have there. You're going to have local produce and things like that.
Correct, because we have this massive hall. I suggested to the local organizers that we have regional exhibitors to a very, very low price for their booth so that they can basically present their local produce so that the participants can do a little bit of souvenir shopping and try a little bit of things from the area. Because I actually find it always difficult when going to a conference and when trying to find a gift to take home. It's always so busy. So I thought, why not bring this into the conference as well? A little bit of a local touch.
Sounds good. St. Gallen's a smallish sort of city within Switzerland, but it's pretty easy to get to by the sound of it.
Yeah, it is smallish, and also even in Swiss standard, it is only around 80,000 people live in the actual city. It is very good connected to Zurich Airport, so you fly into Zurich, and then it's just under an hour by train, which runs every 20 minutes, pretty much day and night, into St. Gallen. So it's very easy to get to. But even if it's very small, it is a major hub for the eastern part of Switzerland. So we are serving a large area of Switzerland and a whole lot of countryside. So many people from the fairly densely populated countryside come to St. Gallen for their main city. So therefore, it offers way more than another smallish city would offer with 80,000 people.
What about the pricing?
Pricing, we will have an early bird rate for TIAFT members of 600 Swiss francs, which is at the moment, I think, around $650. That does not include the excursion. We had to exclude the excursion in order to meet criteria for sponsorship agreements. So there is some testing that you're not bribing people when going to a conference. So therefore, the excursion is excluded and you can register the excursion separately for 90 francs. So even including the excursion, it is only 690 francs early bird. So I encourage everyone to come also to the excursion and register to the excursion as well.
That sounds good, Jochen. Hopefully we can make it.
Yeah, hopefully many can make it, and we can have many people from around the world here in St. Gallen and show off our beautiful little part and show them a little bit the countryside and the mountains surrounding. We don't have beaches or anything like that, but we do have a lot of mountains.
Yeah, it looks spectacular. Thank you very much, Jochen, and all the best for the meeting next year.
Thanks for having me here at the TalkSpot.
Registration is now open for the 61st annual TAFT meeting taking place from the 2nd to the 6th of September 2024 in St. Gallen, Switzerland. The early bird rate is only available until May 31st, so be sure to register soon for the reduced rate at www.taft2024.org. We look forward to welcoming you to St. Gallen for an inspiring, engaging, and enlightening conference.